It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an expert on public shootings tells us about the challenges facing school districts when they respond to threats of violence that come from social media platforms. Now, a new study is highlighting the ongoing obesity epidemic in the United States. According to researchers at Johns Hopkins University, more than half of people between the ages of 18 and 25 are either overweight or obese. Some other findings: back in the late 1970s, 18% of people in that age group were considered overweight. Now it's 24%. But the really eye-opening part has to do with obesity. Back then, only 6% were obese. Today, that number, 33%. That weight can put people at risk for certain health problems, including serious complications from COVID-19. So how did we get here? What would it take to turn things around? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is behind the increase in overweight and obesity here in the United States? Do you see solutions out there? Is this something that's affected your life personally? Have you worked to lose weight? It is a challenge. We all know that. How has it gone for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes is an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She worked on this obesity study. Dr. Ellison Barnes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, we've heard that we're getting heavier as a country. Were these results of your study a surprise to you?
So you're right. We've known from other studies that obesity rates have been rising in all age groups. So it was not a surprise at all to find that they have risen among those who are age 18 to 25. However, we actually were surprised by the magnitude. To find that now the average, the mean weight of an individual 18 through 25 now falls in the overweight range was surprising, and really just the magnitude of the increase that we saw in obesity was I think important to take note of.
Can you talk about why you focused on this 18 to 25 age range, a pivotal age of life for a lot of people?
Yeah. So, emerging adulthood is a really unique developmental stage. This is the time when people are leaving home, potentially living on their own for the first time, either going to college or entering the workforce, or perhaps going to school and then entering the workforce. They're, in new relationships, both social and romantic. It's a time of immense change. And ultimately, at the end of that period, people kind of have their adult identity somewhat formed. So the habits that are developed in this emerging adult period often stick with people through the rest of their life. So we really see it as a time when there's both the sort of increased risk of developing obesity, and also it's a potential period to intervene and prevent that from happening, to prevent the long-term health consequences of obesity.
And as I understand
it, that's why we wanted to see what's been going on.
Sure. As I understand it from the Johns Hopkins press release on this, part of your worry is that we don't study this age group and obesity trends maybe as much as we should. Why is that?
Exactly. So often, we think about children, we think about adolescents, and then we think about adults. And this age group, this 18 to 25 group, often gets bunched in with either adolescents, which often extends, the definitions often extend into the early 20s, or young adults, which the definition of young adults is totally variable depending on what you're looking at, but can extend up into, nearly 40 years of age. And so, I think 18-year-olds are very different from 40-year-olds. 11-year-olds or 12-year-olds who are adolescents are very different from 25-year-olds. So looking at this period, by itself is something that I think is not done enough.
We're talking to Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, looking at new research she was part of, finding substantial increases for young adults, 18 to 25-year-olds, when it comes to being overweight and especially obesity. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions about the study, maybe your own experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Ellison Barnes, can you talk about some of the health risks, short and long term, that we associate with obesity in particular?
Sure. So we know that obesity is associated with a number of long-term health problems. These include hypertension or high blood pressure, which long-term can lead to heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, diabetes, which also in turn can lead to heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, as well as eye problems, nerve damage, chronic pain, fatty liver, which can eventually progress to cirrhosis and ultimately liver failure, sleep apnea, arthritis due to stress on the joints. Some types of cancer are more likely in the context of obesity. And then psychological issues as well. So low self-esteem, social exclusion, anxiety and depression. We also see, you know, a lot of absenteeism, school academic issues, which can affect kind of long-term life outcomes. And so, you know, the array of health problems that we know are associated with obesity is quite broad.
Now, you used BMI, body mass index, as kind of your measure of overweight and obesity. Can you talk about what that is and how it works as a measurement?
Sure. So BMI is a measure that looks at how much a person weighs compared to how tall they are. And the specific formula to calculate it is the weight in kilograms divided by the height in meter squared. You're welcome to do that for yourself on paper, or there's plenty of calculators available if you Google. The CDC and the NIH both have BMI calculators. And BMI helps us, you know, thinking on a population level or for research, to get an understanding of where things stand at a population level from a weight perspective. And on an individual level, it's I think useful in like the medical context to get an idea of how, you know, where someone's weight falls. It's a little bit less useful on the individual level in the sense that the BMI measure can't differentiate muscle and fat. It underpredicts risk in certain ethnicities, things like that. So certainly I think it's a good way to get a sense of what's going on, but isn't always, it's not always 100% reliable on the individual level.
Right. I understand if you're a football player, your BMI might look high, but that doesn't mean you're overweight or obese. That's the problem at the individual level. On average, though, exactly. We know that most of us aren't football players.
Correct. Exactly. Which is why on a population level, it gives us a good idea of where population weight as a whole stands.
Now, what do you look at for causes? This is going on, this increase at a population level. I know a lot of people struggle with weight at an individual level. Is this just lots of us are making health choices that are leading to this? Or do you look for underlying changes in how, I don't know what? What are you looking at for causes?
Oh, so I wish I had an easy, you know, one-line right. answer for you here, but
everybody
I don't.
Does, I think.
Yeah, obesity is really, you know, truly a multifactorial disease. And I think there really isn't one reason that accounts for the changes that we've seen in obesity rates over time. The things that we think about are, yes, there have been changes in diet, which, you know, at an individual level might be related to choices and, you know, what people choose to eat. However, this is influenced by the marketing of unhealthy foods, the easy availability in the food environment of calorie-dense fast food and processed food, limited access to fresh foods in certain neighborhoods. And then on the other side, physical activity. Many jobs now are requiring less physical activity than in the past. We are, as a society, we're very reliant on cars to get around. We don't necessarily do a lot of walking. There's been a huge increase in screen time, you know, not only TV, but computers and cell phones and tablets. And these are playing a role, but then there's also factors that I think are talked about less, things like decreased sleep duration, stress, environmental exposures, and all of these factors interact at the individual level with, you know, one given person's biological and genetic kind of predisposition to obesity. So I think, yes, there are individual factors, but there's also these broad kind of societal factors that are playing a role as well. And I don't think that, you know, any one of these can be pointed to as the sole culprit. It's really a very complex interplay of factors that's led to these changing rates over time.
We're talking about rising levels of obesity in the United States with Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes, assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, co-author of a new study on the levels of obesity among younger adults. We're talking 18 to 25 in the United States. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is causing this increase? If you're in this 18 to 25 age group, do you see this as a common problem? Is this a topic of conversation among you and your friends? What would you point toward when it comes to possible solutions? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about obesity in the United States. A new study from Johns Hopkins University shows that over half of people between ages 18 and 25 are overweight or obese. Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes is an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins. She worked on this study, and you can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Carrick is with us in Beaver Dam. Carrick, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So you guys were talking about BMI earlier, and I'm within that 18 to 25-year-old range. And according to my BMI, I'm obese. But they don't, for me, it doesn't really, BMI doesn't work for me. I played football in high school. I'm an 18-year-old that's 6'3", 230 pounds. So according to BMI, I'm overweight, but I'm a perfectly healthy 18-year-old, haven't had a medical issue in my life. But compared to other high schoolers that I went with that were morbidly obese, compared to what I've seen my grandparents, they showed me pictures of people in the 60s and 70s, and almost nobody was obese back then.
Carrick, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Again, you talked about this, Dr. Ellison Barnes. They're at an individual level, BMI can trick us a little bit. At the population level, it's a little more useful.
Exactly. No, you're a perfect example of where, you know, for someone who is a football player, this might not be the best measure to use.
Thanks for that call, Carrick. But his point, he is seeing in his community, colleagues, fellow students who weren't athletes, who do have that higher BMI that might qualify them for obesity, something that he didn't see, as he said, in his grandparents' generation. That kind of matches the data you've collected.
Exactly. I mean, the rise that we've seen over the last several decades is stunning.
Thanks for the call, Carrick. We'll go to Chris now in Kenosha. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Thank you. I am 52 years old, and let me tell you, in the 80s, when my friends and I were teenagers, we obsessed about the same issue. So it's very unfortunate. It has not changed. And my question is, and I feel like it does have to do with activity and with calorie-dense foods. But let me tell you, none of us played computer games, and we were all fixated and obsessed about body image and weight. And the fact that it's only gotten worse is very sad, because it's so overwhelming to the mind and mental health. But my question is, what do you think about additives and food in terms of the vitamins? This has so many vitamins in it, and this has so many vitamins added to it, as though it's supposed to be healthy. But do you think there's anything about the lack of nutrients with infants, you know, to the mother in the womb, and how it affects the metabolism later on? Could that be something happening? There has to be something going on.
I gotcha. Thanks a lot, Dr. Ellison Barnes. She's worried about food today being different than it was. I don't know. There's a lot of bad stuff when I was a kid in the 80s, too. But is there something different about our food system now?
So I think as a whole, there's a lot of processed foods that are, you know, easily available, high calorie processed foods that honestly are, you know, often more affordable than some of the healthier choices. And that food has been heavily marketed, particularly to children, and also, you know, certain socioeconomic populations as well. And so I think it's true that the overall food environment has changed, and really the easy availability of calories is something that's, you know, increased over time.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Julia joins us next in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi, I'm a social psychologist, and I think part of the problem is that this is one of the last groups that we can stigmatize against in the United States. And as a result, we hold people individually responsible for it, and then it prevents people from exercising, getting treatment, having honest conversations with their doctors. I think we'd be better off if we stopped stigmatizing people for their obesity and looked at the multifactorial nature of where this problem comes from.
Julia, thanks a lot for the call. And Dr. Ellison Barnes, that concern about stigma and shame not being a great solution at the individual level for obesity.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, when we were talking about factors that have played into this increase, you know, I was trying to stress that, yes, there are individual factors, but so much of this is informed by what's happening in the social and structural environment in our society. And, you know, for an individual to sort of go against that flow is very challenging. Speaking as a primary care physician, I'm not a weight management specialist. I'm a primary care physician. And when I'm talking to my patients about obesity, no matter what their BMI, I really try to have my patients focus on healthy behaviors rather than the numbers. You know, I'm less concerned if your BMI is 24 or 26. I'm concerned with, you know, what kind of diet are you eating? Are you incorporating fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts into your diet? Are you avoiding added sugars, healthy processed food, highly processed foods? Are you getting physical activity? Most of us really don't get enough, myself included. Are you trying to reduce stress in your life where it's possible and get adequate sleep? And so really focusing on living your best healthy life rather than on the weight. And because it's true that there is a lot of stigma associated with obesity. And as a caller said, that doesn't help anybody in terms of addressing this.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, I mean, that sounds like pretty good universal advice, the handful of things dealing with stress, dealing with better nutrition, getting more activity. Do you hope, do you think we could turn around this bigger problem that you're tracking in your research by all of us taking those simpler messages and not worrying about, like you said, the numbers?
I don't know. I think that if on the individual level, if we all, you know, move toward that, I think that it would make a big difference. I do think that we need to sort of think about things at a broader society and policy level as well, you know, increasing access to and affordability of healthy food, encouraging built environments that are actually conducive to physical activity. All of this can't happen on the individual level. It's just not enough.
Dr. Allison Barnes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes is an assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We talked to her today about the United States obesity epidemic, including a new study she worked on showing more than half of young U.S. adults, talking ages 18 to 25, there are overweight or obese. In the third year that schools are trying to figure out how to keep kids safe from COVID-19 in the classroom, some schools have decided to leave the classroom behind. Madeline Fox went into the Kickapoo Valley Forest in Lafarge to a school that's outside all year round.
Students and staff start their morning with a song. The key to holding class outside all year in a state where it regularly drops well below freezing is clothing, specifically layers, as demonstrated by 5-year-old Mia Scher.
I have this coat under this coat, and this.
Mia is one of 29 students in pre-K and kindergarten at the Kickapoo Valley Forest School, a public charter school in the Lafarge School District. She and her classmates are outside pretty much all day, every day.
When some of the children arrived here on day one, I don't think they really, of course, knew what they were getting into. And there were children saying, like, when are we going inside?
That's Janelle Kisa, education director at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve.
And we were able to say, well, we're not. We're going to play outside all day. And now they don't even ask anymore. They just love to be outside.
For the last few years, the Kickapoo Valley Forest School only did a half-day educational program on Fridays. This is its first year of being on a regular school's 5-day regular length school day schedule. The 5-day school was in the works before COVID-19 hit, but Kisa says the pandemic gave it a little push.
We really had people saying, like, gosh, we want our kids to gather, we want them to have social experiences, but we want them to do it outside where it's safe.
In some ways, outdoor school is a lot like indoor school.
The teachers will often bring learning materials, whether it's math or reading, out into the forest, set up a blanket or a rug, and sit with small groups of children to do instruction.
Jason Rood went into teaching as a second career after he saw few male teachers when his own kids started school. He convinced his teaching program to let him do his hands-on experience at the Kickapoo Valley Forest School, where he's one of the teachers who work with kids on their letters and numbers.
Ooh, this one I think is in your name.
I'm listening to these guys.
E. E, and how does the E sound in your name?
E.
Eh.
School outdoors also has some key differences from more traditional schools. Most days, the kids walk close to 2 miles, hiking through the forest preserve. One week, they gathered walnut hulls and then spent a morning cooking those walnuts down over their fire pit into dye. They brought white t-shirts, and teacher Jimena Puig helped them use an evergreen branch to sprinkle the dye into patterns on their shirt.
If it gets on your snow pants, honey, it will dye your snow pants too. So.
Puig is one of the teachers who helped shape the forest school's curriculum last year while they were planning for full-time students. She says the outdoor time is good for the kids to get their energy out and learn through interactive play, but it's also good for the future for everyone.
The love that they start to develop for their environment, which is critical for our survival as human beings, that our children come to love and appreciate and care for the environment around them. That is happening because we're out in it.
The Kickapoo Valley Forest School's default is to be outside all day, except nap time, rain, snow, or sun, unless it's so cold that prolonged outside time would be too dangerous. But traditionally, indoor schools have also had some success adding outdoor time, like the Lacouture Ojibwe School in Hayward. Mary Robinson teaches Ojibwe language to grades 9 through 12, which she says works well outside because it's first and foremost a spoken language that can be spoken anywhere.
Especially for Native students, it's really important for all of us to be connected still to the earth and the environment and the outdoors, and we've lost a lot of that by coming inside.
She started taking her students outside last spring after the school brought students back in person, and continued this fall.
We still will go outside occasionally when it's chilly out. We haven't been doing it as much lately because high school students don't like to wear coats and boots very much.
Even if she can't bring her teenagers out as much as she'd like, Robinson is part of a trend of schools and families that got their kids outside because of COVID-19, but see it lasting past the pandemic. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, a fake social media trend brought fake threats of violence to schools around the country, leading some to close on Friday. We'll learn more about how school districts evaluate threats, even vague threats, and the best ways to keep kids safe at schools. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a cognitive scientist explains a new theory about why we may be having extra weird dreams during the pandemic. Now, at least two Wisconsin school districts canceled classes on Friday as the country reacted to fake viral threats on social media. Many districts issued statements and increased police presence in response to claims of a trend on the social media app TikTok. Police officials across the state found the threats to be non-credible, but it raised questions about student safety and how school districts should handle these types of threats. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see reports of this TikTok alleged trend popping up maybe on your own social media? How did your local school district respond? Do you think it responded appropriately? If you work in a school district, how do you try to evaluate threats, whether they're a call to the school or some kind of vague social media meme? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University and a co-founder of The Violence Project. Jillian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to take us to the end of last week. We had these series of messages people were posting on TikTok, not threats, not even people saying, you know, they had seen threats, but saying, hey, this is a day when lots of people are going to be making these threats. Can you talk about that? What happened in the position that put school administrators in?
Yeah, we've seen across the country, really since about September this year, we've been tracking these threats, and we've seen a consistent rise in the number of threats that schools are getting across the country. And then in the weeks post the Oxford High School shooting, it really skyrocketed, where we were just seeing hundreds of threats per week that schools were having to navigate. Then this happened at the end of last week, where there was a TikTok challenge that declared Friday American School Shooting Day. And this went viral across the country, and schools were in this incredibly difficult position of having to figure out, is it credible? Is it not credible? How do we respond? And I think in the wake of the Oxford shooting, schools wanted to over-respond rather than under-respond.
Can you talk about what kind of things schools can do when they see a threat of whatever sort, as I mentioned, a threatening call or social media post targeting their school, a nationwide vague threat like we saw at the end of last week? What kind of things should be on the checklist of schools to try to figure out if this is credible or not?
Yeah, the most important thing is actually to put some systems in place before sort of a threat hits your school. So things like having reporting mechanisms, anonymous reporting mechanisms, ideally, that kids and parents can use, talking to kids in the school about the importance of reporting things, if they see something, to say something, and that that report will be met with kind of care and concern rather than swift criminal charges. We want to increase kids reporting when they're noticing things. The ideal situation is have either a threat assessment team or a crisis intervention team, but a team of people at the school that includes public safety, school administrators, mental health professionals that can evaluate that threat in the context of that student's life or in the context of the school and figure out kind of the right way to move forward.
The worry on that side of things would be if there are so many non-credible threats. It seems like schools are going to be tying up a lot of resources and in staff and things like that, understandably so, in dealing with these things that aren't going to emerge as threats.
Yeah, and that's the sort of nightmare thing about this, is that schools are trying to educate our kids. They're strapped for resources. They have to choose between buying textbooks and buying, you know, surveillance technology. They're being put in this really difficult position of having to figure out, is each threat credible or not? What we do know from our research on mass shooters is that they do leak their plans ahead of time, and they do tend to threaten before they do it. We saw that just play out a few weeks ago. And so every time a threat happens, it has to be taken seriously. But knowing that the vast majority of them are going to be jokes or hoaxes and nothing to actually be worried about.
Talking to Jillian Peterson from the Violence Project and associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University, looking at threats to schools, threats of school shootings, and how schools can respond and try to sort out non-credible from, sadly, credible threats. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you've experienced in your district, whether you're a student, a parent, a teacher, or staff at a school? Do you have systems in place if you work in a school to deal with these kinds of threats? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Pete is with us in Bondwell. Pete, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Pete?
Yeah. So in our school district, we received a somewhat vague general email that went out to all of the parents in the district that explained there was some sort of social media message going around that increased the perception of potential danger to the children, but we didn't get any detail, right? So we were able to use that email to initiate a conversation with our child, but it was really difficult to have that conversation without more detail, more facts. It was really hard to make that assessment and have a more productive conversation with our kid about what was happening, what's appropriate, what are the options, how are they feeling, what are they hearing. They did a good job as far as promoting the awareness, but I think in these situations, you know, if you're going to trust the parents to have those conversations, you know, equip them with all the detail that's available so we can, you know, dig into what are you seeing, what are you hearing, how do you want to deal with this.
And Pete, can I ask, how old is your kid?
He is 14.
Okay. And on Friday, if you made the decision for him to go to school, was it a more stressful school day for all concerned than usual?
Had solid conversation, and he helps people going, but
Your line's breaking up, Pete. I'm sorry, but thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. Jillian, an incident like this, the parent gets that notification, wonders what to tell their kid. There's a lot of stress there. Do you have thoughts on how to handle that, what schools should be telling parents in these situations?
Yeah, schools are in a really difficult position because a lot of times their hands are actually pretty tied about what they can even legally say about a situation, what they're allowed to say about another student. But we do know that the more communication, the more parents know, the better. Even if it makes them uncomfortable, even if it's the school kind of not trying to scare everyone, the more information, the better. And I think this also goes back to the importance of having these conversations ahead of time so that the community knows when our school gets a threat, here's the process. It's reported here, it's analyzed by these three people, we figure out if it's credible or not, we follow up with resources, we make an intervention plan so that parents kind of trust that the school has a system for handling this and knows how to handle it. So it doesn't feel like, you know, this is out of the blue and everybody is kind of terrified, because it's really scary. It's really anxiety provoking, not just for parents and kids, for teachers and staff. I've talked to, you know, teachers and principals across the country that are kind of at their wit's end already. And then you add in the threat of a school shooting and it's just overwhelming.
Pete, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Sorry, we lost your line there in your second response. Let's go now to Austin in Racine. Austin, hello.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
Not much. How are you doing? What do you want to bring up, Austin?
So one thing that I noticed is earlier when you were talking about ways to, like, build up better environments in schools, just something for, like, everyone to think about is, like, involving police in this is categorically a bad idea, because, you know, we've seen when you involve a lot more police in the schools, students of color get disproportionately targeted. And also, cops have done nothing to stop school shootings that they are placed in. And what we need to do instead of bringing quote unquote law and order into this is we need to build better environments for students, you know, and that's what we just need to do, period, in community.
Austin, thanks a lot for that call. Jillian, first of all, you and your colleagues at the Violence Project have looked at the role of police in school safety. What do we know?
Yeah, we did a study where we actually looked at schools where there was either carried out a school mass shooting or attempted mass shooting. And surprisingly, we found that schools that had school resource officers on the ground actually had more casualties than schools that didn't. The reason we think this is that over 90% of perpetrators of school shootings are students of that school. They are kids who are in crisis. They are actively suicidal. And typically a school shooting is sort of meant to be a suicide in addition to being a homicide. We've talked to perpetrators of school shootings who say the police officer there was actually the reason why I went, hoping that I would be killed in the act. Now, when it comes to threats, a lot of what the caller says is correct. We know that if somebody is in crisis, they're actively suicidal, they're making this threat. Our research shows it really is a cry for help. You don't say that publicly if you're not looking for someone to intervene. It's kind of this last ditch cry for help to see if anyone's listening. So the way we want to intervene is with resources, is with intervention, is really not things like criminal charges, which is just going to exacerbate the grievance with the school, exacerbate the crisis. Now, it's harder when there's an actual weapon involved. When there's an actual gun involved, then oftentimes the police do need to get involved. But if it's just a threat, there's a lot of different strategies that schools can use to figure out how to really holistically intervene to make sure that kid sort of gets off that pathway.
Austin, thanks for the call. We're talking about school threats and safety with Jillian Peterson, Associate Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the role of social media and social media platforms, the way that threats can go viral online? What responsibility do they have to regulate online threats? What do you see in your own school district when it comes to how threats are reported, maybe to parents, to students, how these things are handled from your viewpoint as a student, a parent, a school staff. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Hamline University criminal justice professor Jillian Peterson about threats and school safety. Jillian's co-founder of The Violence Project. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've seen from your local school district and law enforcement when it comes to evaluating threats, credible, non-credible? Has this issue come up in your school in the last week, in the last few months? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jillian, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to share a story. Her son was kicked out, she says, of school for making a threat. She says he needs mental health resources, but the school doesn't have them, and the only tool they seem to have is suspensions, wondering what can be done to help out those kids. Obviously, traumatic for all the kids involved and for the mom in this case. Jillian, what kind of resources do schools need?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of times what the school has at their disposal is things like suspensions, expulsions, criminal charges. Our research on mass shooters, what we know they have in common is that they often have trauma histories. They are in an active crisis, they're suicidal, they really need mental health intervention. That, you know, excluding a child, pushing them out, it really just makes matters worse. But a lot of schools just don't have those resources in place. So when we think about how do we make our schools safer, what does public safety look like? I think things like mental wellness, you know, school counselors, school social workers, school-based mental health has to be a really important part of that discussion. That's just as much school safety and may, in fact, be more effective than things like, you know, security cameras and metal detectors at the doors.
We had our caller Austin earlier saying he would want to see schools create a better environment. One, I imagine, where kids could come forward to say, hey, I need help, where kids could report potential problems without fear of, as you mentioned earlier, kind of retaliation against the student who's making suspected threats. What kind of culture would you like to see in schools in addition to the research resources you were just talking about?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. So in a lot of the cases we've studied, you know, there were school shooting cases where 50 kids knew it was going to happen and nobody told an adult. And so we really need warm, welcoming environments with really strong and trusting relationships between students and adults in the building. Kids are having such a hard time right now. They're in crisis in so many ways coming out of this pandemic that they really need adults who have the time and energy and space to kind of listen to them, to notice when things are off or when things are different, to have systems in place where they can report students that they're concerned about and that somebody will follow up. So anything we can do to really build those strong, trusting relationships, that's another really important piece of violence prevention.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brian is on the line in Hollandale. Brian, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Brian?
A couple months ago on Facebook and other social media, I believe it was, they had the Dads in School group in Louisiana. I don't know if you guys remember that or not. It was the school district that had like 30-some fights in a couple of weeks.
Right, Brian, I have seen that, Jillian. I've seen headlines of, as our caller was saying, dads showing up to kind of just be there, be a presence in schools. I think the report on Louisiana saw at least a short-term turnaround on violence. What do you think of the idea of volunteer parents on campus maybe being that extra set of eyes, but maybe that trusted adult who somebody could talk to?
You know, I think schools need all the help they can get, and certainly parents are a really important partner in all of this. So kind of the more adults around that students can go to, that they can have conversations with, the more people around that can de-escalate situations, that can notice kids in crisis, that's all going to be better. We know that, you know, schools really need more resources right now. And if that's volunteers and if that's parents, that's fantastic.
Thanks for the call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the ways that schools deal with threats, individual threats, wider spread social media threats of school violence. Jillian Peterson is with us from Hanlon University, co-founder of The Violence Project. Jillian, one response we've seen in schools around the country is a lot of investment in safety technologies, different kinds of door locks and surveillance systems and things like that. Again, you and your colleagues have looked at that. What do we know about whether those investments are paying off?
Yeah, in the book we published this fall called The Violence Project, we have a whole section where we look at this kind of whole school security industry. And it's a $3 billion industry. It's massive. Again, it goes back to the fact that the most likely perpetrator by far is a student of that school. The student is in the building. They are going in and out of these doors and these systems every day. They know exactly how everything works. They're running through all the active shooter drills. They know where the SRO is located. These are insiders, not outsiders. In some ways, it makes it a lot harder to prevent because all of that technology is based on the fact that it's an outsider coming in. But in some ways, it makes it easier because we can think about what sorts of systems and things do we need in our school to make sure none of these kids are going to want to do this.
We had another caller who couldn't stay on the line. Just wonders how parents should go about talking to their children about these kinds of issues. This could be a whole separate conversation, but when it comes to safety in particular, what do you want to see parents talking to their kids about when it comes to reporting potential threats?
Yeah, I think just opening up those lines of conversation about A, how they're doing with this. This increases anxiety. This can make kids feel really afraid. And so opening up those conversations, we know just getting kids talking is actually really helpful, but also talking to kids about the importance of when they notice something is off with a friend or when they see something that concerns them, who do they report, how do they report, and why do they report? Also for parents, there's really this sort of critical component of safe storage of firearms. We know that kids who do this almost always use guns they take from their parents. So schools encouraging safe storage campaigns is another thing that parents can do within their own home.
I want to bring things around back to social media platforms that kind of kicked off our conversation with this alleged TikTok trend last week. Are there things that we could learn from this that you'd like to see maybe the social media platforms themselves do differently?
There are, and I think we're just getting started on these conversations with social media companies and what is their responsibility for things that go viral on their own platforms. You know, schools across the country cannot shut down every time there's a threat that goes viral on social media. So I think what role do social media companies play in this and what's their responsibility is a huge question. Kids, we know a really important part of the equation when it comes to school shooters is this kind of social validation that they look for people on social media that are validating their thinking, that are telling them it's a good idea. They're in chat rooms, they're in the dark corners of the internet. And so if social media companies are providing that validation to kids that this is okay and this is normalizing, you know, that is something we really need a bigger national conversation about.
Just in our last couple minutes or so, what kind of things would you encourage school leaders to be doing right now to start to get the systems in place that you're hoping to see?
Yeah, I think creating just a reporting mechanism. It can be as simple as an email address or a Google form. Getting a team in place, a formal team that can assess these threats that they come in and making sure that they have their communication systems in place. And so that everybody in the school, the kids, the staff, the parents know how to report concerns and understand how they're going to be evaluated and dealt with.
And we've got, of course, this pandemic. We're just coming in a lot of these schools out of a long time of kids not being in the schools. Has that thrown whole new wrinkles into how we think about threats?
It really has. Because all the risk factors for violence, things like isolation and hopelessness and long times online have really gone through the roof in the pandemic. And also, teachers are really good at noticing when kids are off, kind of noticing when there's a change in behavior from baseline. But having not been around kids for so long, we really don't know the baseline of these kids. So it's hard to assess when something seems off. So it just makes this whole thing so much harder.
Jillian, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University, co-founder of The Violence Project, and co-author of a book called The Violence Project. We talked to her and her co-author earlier this year. You can find that conversation in our archives at WPR.org. She joined us today for a look at threats of school violence on social media and how schools can assess the risks when there is a threat, sometimes even a vague threat like that. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. This week, a look at the wide world of smart appliances and smart gadgets for around the home. What is worth getting? What's a waste of money? What could even be a security risk? Call in with your own experiences, the gadgets you have around the house, the ones you're maybe wondering about getting for Christmas. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Last week on Food Friday, we got some good advice on Christmas cookies. You can still find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we'll get some fun baking advice for other desserts this coming Friday. But let's not leave out a holiday classic, love it or hate it, the fruitcake. Producer Bill Martins forwarded me an article about the long history of the fruitcake with a note, by the way, some fruitcakes are good. According to this article on The Conversation, the origins of fruitcake goes way back to ancient Rome through medieval Europe. They had a big takeoff here in the U.S. for two reasons. One, they were soaked in booze, which helped preserve them, which was a good idea when you didn't have refrigeration. And two, the U.S. Postal Service. When the post office started offering rural free delivery, it opened the door to mail order food, especially those foods that didn't need to stay cold. Today, even though there's a lot of fruitcake jokes, it's estimated that over 2 million are sold in the U.S. each year. Probably too late to get one shipped in time now, but you could still make your own. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.